Chen, it's so great that once again, we have decided on a meeting place and we're both here.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful to be back at standing outside the shed at Villa Marguerite. How was your evening, Caitlin? What did you do down at your French resort?
It was great because I was at a French resort. So I enjoyed fine foods, you know, definitely made use of the pool and the beach. Mm. And I just really enjoyed watching you struggle below as I looked out from the balcony and then went on to my life of finery.
That was nice to see you. You looked, I will say you looked magnificently elegant standing on that balcony with the wind just kind of like blowing your awesome outfit and robe behind you. It was very, very glamorous. It was really impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you felt small.
Small is one way to say it. I was a little bit, I will be honest, I was a little bit distracted. I was trying to, I had found some mussels just in like knee-deep water off of the beach. And I was trying to pry them open with my thumbs. And I got a couple of them open. And sorry if I'm a little ripe too, because I fell asleep sleeping with my right side of my face in the sand. And so it's just a little grimy and stuff. But, you know, nonetheless.
Yeah. You'll be fine. Yeah. We won't allow you in the house, but you're fine out here in the shed.
I'm fine standing outside the shed. Excellent. So, Caitlin, what chapter are we about to discuss from the murder on the Lynx?
I cannot be more delighted to share with you the chapter title, but then also to share with you what my book says the chapter title is. So I think first I'll just tell you what the actual title is, which is The Second Body. Because, you know, we have just learned Hastings ran from his resort hotel room right next door to mine to Villa Marguerite because we now know that someone else has died. And so naturally it would be called The Second Body. However, my book says, this amazing book made in a back alley, says The Second Baby. And when I realized that, I have to say, I think it was late at night. I've been taking notes for a while, and I am ashamed to admit, or maybe proud to admit, that my first thought was, where was the first baby? It took me a second, and I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I feel like they meant to say body. And, like, I honestly don't think that babies are ever involved in Poirot's universe. Because, like, I just think they would be too chaotic for him. If golf is too much, I think that babies just, they should not be allowed within, like, a 50-foot radius of him. Because he would just be like, oh, no. Get this away from me.
Okay, so chapter 14, The Second Baby or The Second Body, depending on what edition you're reading. This is where Hastings works a little bit with Giraud concerning the discovery and the investigation of the second body. And should we get into what the second body is now, or should we wait?
Gosh, I feel like we've already told everyone. Okay. So why don't you just tell them what's actually happening? And I think that'll make the unraveling and the untangling make more sense later.
Okay. So what's actually happening is that, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, because again, I think I'm mixing it up with the PBS version.
Okay, no worries.
And I feel this is like, as Mrs. Renault and Mr. Renault were hatching the plan of how to get Paul Renault, Mr. Renault, away from France, and then they could eventually meet up again at some point. So they're plotting his fake murder. A drifter wanders onto the estate and gets into an argument with Paul. And
that's never explained.
It's okay. So that's never explained. Okay. And then the drifter, I believe, has a seizure of some sort.
In this book, the word they use is like an epileptic fit.
An epileptic fit. So the drifter has an epileptic fit, and Paul sees this as an opportunity to escape by stabbing the man after he has died in the heart with a nut, with one of the knives that Jack has given to people.
Mm-hmm. One of the three knives. He's just, let's just say, he's very fast and loose with all these knife gifts.
He really is. I mean, if I would have gotten one and realized that two other people got it, I'd be like,
"This isn't
come on, Jack. Here. Come on, man. What's going on? Yeah. I thought we were buddies." But because that's how I talk to men. And so, but the thing is that then the idea is that the body of the Drifter will be, and this is gross, but facially mutilated to the point that the authorities won't be able to think that it's anyone except Paul Renaud when Mrs. Renaud mm-hmm. identifies it as Paul. Yes. So that's the whole thing. So it's not really a murder. It's the death of someone by natural causes that then is used mm-hmm. as part of the plot for Paul to disappear.
One person's death is another person's opportunity.
That's exactly right.
That's going to be the name of my motivational book that I write.
Right. My second baby publications. Yeah.
Or my TED Talk. Oh, my God. Okay, so I'm glad you explained this. So yeah, Paul Renaud, before he's killed by Marthe, he gets to the point where he's dug the grave. He has put his own clothes on this stranger dead man. And that's, I think, it. Because like he has the pipe ready to go to mutilate this poor man's face. And then he's killed by Marthe. Marthe runs away. And Jack and Bella stumble upon the body at the same time. That's where we get the missed connection. Or like, not a missed connection. What is it?
A misinterpretation?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. A misinterpretation. And then hijinks ensue because both of them are trying to protect each other.
Correct. They each think the other person probably killed Paul Renaud. And so now they're like very wary of who gets arrested and why.
Nobody knows this at this point. But this is why we're seeing this second body, and Hastings and Giraud, who are both just like hopeless, are kind of trying to figure it out because Poirot is gone to Paris and he has told Hastings to watch Giraud.
I don't like how Hastings starts to think that Giraud might be right. A little bit.
Hastings is so fickle.
Yeah. I mean, not that I demand loyalty from all of my podcast co-hosts, Caitlin, but
oh, well, then what was that contract I said? Right,
exactly, in blood. But no, but, but it was there was a very queasy feeling for me reading this, where I'm just like, just, you know, Poirot is right and he's your man, so just, you know, come on, stick with him.
Okay, I think this too, as we've been talking about the interesting reflections and relationship between this detective non-detective triangle, I also think that Giraud is the detective that Hastings always wants Poirot to be if Poirot were right, if the like Giraud version were right. That's his like ideal. And then Poirot is constantly like shaking up Hastings's version of what detection means. And because he's also like a goldfish that way, he always has to be constantly reminded that Poirot's method is right. And he's just like always looking for and maybe always kind of falling in love with the Giraud's of the world.
Rather than Poirot standing in the corner like screaming triple pig and no one knows what he's talking about, right? So it's like, but that's the price you pay for the genius of Poirot if you're Hastings, whereas we get to just luxuriate in because we love it.
Because we love it, yeah. Oh, Hastings. I feel like if Hastings and Poirot were a romantic couple, I would have to sit them down and be like, you're never going to give each other what you want.
Oh.
You have to part ways.
Yeah.
Like one of them wants to get married. The other one wants to travel the world. You know, just kind of the things of you're just like, you two have very different worldviews and life projects, and they're never going to connect.
No, they never will. And that's why they need to just keep it the way that it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's go into the details. So Hastings, he like rushes into the shed, which is like right where we're standing. And he finds Giraud on the ground, always on the ground, like the little hound dog. And Giraud is like, Giraud's kind of getting like a little snippy, like throughout the rest of the book. He's really kind of defensive now. And like, so he's like, hey, Hastings, what do you make of this? So Hastings is like, well, let me tell you what I see. And so he tells it to us. He sees like a dead man, middle-aged, dressed in a suit. The same knife is in his chest. And, you know, when Jiro says there's no doubt of something, we know we need to doubt it. He's like, there's no doubt this man died of a stabbing. And of course he didn't. Jiro's like, the dead man must have been dead for a while, so he must have been killed. He kind of identifies that window when Hastings left the shed unlocked. He's like, that's when he must have died. And Hastings is like, well, and he is questioning him a little bit. He's like, that's kind of weird because there were just so many people. You know, we have the International Detective Club plus like all their policemen lackeys that are just nameless. They're all wandering around. So Hastings is like, yeah, I don't know if that would really happen. And Jiro chides Hastings. He's like, you're making all these assumptions. Some detective you are. And of course, there's some dramatic irony because we know that Jiro is the one making all of the assumptions. Right. So then again, they bring Madame Renaud to identify the body. They bring her in. Woman. They say, do you know this person? Yeah, I know. God. She's having it rough, but also it's like, well, you did marry a man with a super secret past.
That's true.
And you're doing whatever you can, even defiling like a stranger's body to like hide this past.
You know what? That's a fair point, Caitlin. Yeah.
That's so like, okay. So Madame Renaud is too calm. You know, she's like, I don't. And we know that like when she's too calm at this point, we know she's lying. And then when she's having a big reaction, we know that she's being genuine, apparently. So she's like, I don't recognize him, but I don't think he was one of the assailants. But like they did wear these crazy dramatic big fake beards. So it could be. Jack is also asked. They're like, who's this dead man in your family home? And he's like, I don't know. And his manner is described as natural. So we get this sense that Madame Renaud knows something, but Jack doesn't. Jiro says then, what about the other? And he means the mysterious Madame Dubray. So that's kind of interesting. Like he kind of is like the other woman, da 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 da. And he accuses Madame Dubray of two murders. And he says that like you killed Monsieur Renaud and you killed this rando because there is one long black hair on the body. And he's like, you have long black hair, so you did everything.
Now, so Madame Dubray, the mysterious Madame Dubray, how does that work with Mrs. Renaud? They bring Mrs. Renaud down.
Let me check.
And then she leaves.
Let me check the second baby.
Okay. It's the worst obstetricians ever.
Okay, so Madame Renaud leaves. She leaves the shed. Jack comes in. And then they're like, bring the other in. The other was Mademoiselle Dubray. Okay. She indignantly protesting vehemence. So, yeah, they also haul her into the shed. And we don't really know where she came from, what she was doing. She's just there.
It is funny to just think of her doing whatever she's doing in her house. And then all of a sudden these like two Keystone cops come in and just like, come on, you got time to go to the shed. Like it's like.
They're like shed time. And she's like,
what?
Good God, again. Yeah. Oh, my God. So they let Madame Dubray go. And Hastings and Jiro, I love this. They're like, man. The dead body certainly looks French and not South American. And they're like, what a bummer. Things would be so much easier if this person was South American. And I have a good quote about Jiro as a dog. He stood there for a moment. Then, with an imperative gesture, he waved me aside. And once more, on hands and knees, I feel like he has to be wearing, like, you know those like gardening or construction knee pads?
Yes.
I think he just like he comes with those in like the Jiro kit that you get.
That's amazing.
like trench coat, but also knee pads.
The Jiro kit.
He was marvelous. So like, okay, Hastings. Nothing escaped him. Inch by inch, he went over the floor, turning over pots, examining old sacks. He pounced, on a bundle by the door, but it proved to be only a ragged coat and trousers. And he flung it down again with a snarl.
Wow.
And we'll learn that actually that's the only important thing there, because that's the actual man's former clothes that he was wearing when he died. So, yeah. So we just get, I mean, with snarl and pounce, we're really just like, okay, he is a hunting dog.
Right.
We get that a lot. Okay. And then Ote enters, and this is where we get that end of the chapter twist. He says, and Ote is like, both Ote and Bex are like kind of onto things way more, and also Giraud's really annoying them at this point. And so Ote says, like, after Giraud's like on his little knee pads, Ote enters and he's like, something more complex is going on here. He says, there is some deep mystery here. And he's not wrong. And then Giraud kind of like updates him on everything they've found. And Ote is like, oh, no. Wait, Giraud. All of this is wrong because this man has most certainly been dead for at least 2 days. And then we end the chapter. So like all of Giraud's timeline and stuff doesn't work out because of course this man has been dead. Again, all these dead bodies festering in the sun. I can't say it enough. Ew. He's been dead for like at least 2, maybe 3 days because he died when Paul was still alive.
Yeah, it's a good thing that the French coast is so breezy.
Yeah, all that sea breeze.
Yeah, just kind of masking the odor and sending it elsewhere.
It's so dark. Yeah, I would love to make like a gothic version of this. I don't know if did the BBC version, and I'll watch it someday. I just kind of like while we do most of the books, I want to like just have the books in my head.
Oh yeah, probably smart. But like, yes.
Do they? Well, no. It's good that one of us is in charge of like watching the movies and shows too. But like, did they take any of that angle with it in the BBC version?
Absolutely not.
Okay, Kenneth Branagh, Kenny B, we've got an idea for you. I would love to see him Venice-ify this book.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah, because like, it's so dark and it's also so sunny. And I want to see those completely contrasted, kind of like we had been talking about with like the blue velvet, like everything that's sunny and perfect is actually like dark and rotting and covered in bugs. Like we need that.
Oh, that would be really fantastic.
Kenneth Branagh, just call us up.
Yep.
Just give us a call.
I love that idea. We won't mention Emma Thompson at all and, you know, maybe yell at you about it. Anyway, sorry. Still angry about that.
I know. After the movie is made, we'll have a little talk with her. We'll have a little sit down.
We'll have a little Chicago talk with him.
Oh, God. What does that mean? Terrified. It's very different than a Seattle talk, which is just silence looking at your phone.
It's just silence and people ignoring you. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kenny B, that's what you're getting. Mm-hmm. That's what you get. Okay, so we are one chapter away from the Brawley case, folks.
Oh.
I know we can do it. All will be totally explained in the Brawley case, but we have one more thing we need to really learn in chapter 15 called A Photograph. Chad, take us away with a little summary. What's happening in this chapter?
So at chapter 15, A Photograph, it's a few different things happen, including some more confirmation of how long the body's been dead. And then mm-hmm. there's also a discussion where Hastings goes in this discussion with someone who works at the train station to kind of ask a bunch of questions about, because you have the thing with like foreigners would have to have left with their fake beards on and there are a bunch of other things too. And then I suppose the main thing getting us back into this is that Poirot returns from Paris and he has found the information that he was looking for.
He comes back with a very special photograph that kind of changes everything. We open the chapter. Everyone is shocked by this revelation about the time of death. Dr. Duran comes in and is like, yep, Oteo's right. Then we get a telegram right after that. Poirot is returning from Paris. And Hastings is like, this is actually very cute. So this is why I'm like, oh, I feel so conflicted about Hastings and Poirot. Because he's like, I'm so excited to see Poirot. What has he learned in Paris? I need to go pick him up. And actually, he had wanted to drop Poirot off. And Poirot had said, no, right. Stay away.
Go keep an eye on Giraud. Yes.
Yeah, like, please go somewhere else and keep yourself busy. So Hastings, he gets to the station early and he's like, you know what? I'm going to do a little investigation. So he talks to a train porter and he's like, did you see two foreigners leave the night of the murder? And the guy is like, no, there is no way I saw two foreigners that night because I definitely would have noticed. So again, there's like that, like the sense of the other is very strong with everyone in this moment. But then he's asking about Jack to see if Jack had like secretly come back from Paris where he's like been pouting. He's in like his Paris pout. If he comes back and maybe like secretly kills his dad and then leaves again. And the porter's like, well, that's weird. Jack wouldn't most definitely not like come back and then leave 30 minutes later. And so Hastings is like, wait, what? And they're like, yeah, Jack arrived here at 11:40 and the last train out of here is at midnight. So like that wouldn't make any sense. Why would he come down here for 20 minutes?
Right.
And so Hastings uncovers that Jack has been in Merlinville that evening. So like that right now we're like building the case for suspicion around Jack. The real reason that Jack has come back is that he's received the telegram from his dad trying to get him out of the way, sending him to Santiago. And so he's like, well, before I leave on my like big epic journey that is a total waste of time, I want to go talk to Marthe and just like tell her that I love her and really make sure that like we both are committed to this. And when I return, we'll still be together. Yeah. And so Hastings, thinking that he's like really onto something, he's like, that's why Marthe was nervous, is that Jack was in Merlinville the night of the murder. And so that's why she has the anxious eyes. And again, we know that's wrong. So Poirot arrives. He's back from Paris. So another train moment. And he's like, I am in such a good mood. He hugs, or they say he embraces Hastings, which I think might actually be like the little like three French smooches on the cheek.
Awesome.
And Hastings is like, whoa, this is not very English of him. He's forgotten his ways. This must mean he's really in a good mood because he's like all of the little like English, I don't know, what would you say it? Like English awkwardness and discomfort that you have to like embody when you're there.
Yeah, the there's no way shaking hands and a pat on the shoulder is like sums up how I'm feeling right now, but that's all I can do. Yeah.
Exactly. And so Poirot is just like, he's full of emotion. He's full of smooches and embracing. And he's like, whatever, Giraud. I love this. He's like, what? And I love, okay, here's the thing. Poirot is so petty. And I love that about him. Like, just as fastidious as he is about his attire, he's like, if you wrong me, I am going to make you feel silly in, like, equal scale, if not more.
It's amazing.
And so he's like, whatever Giraud's been doing, I don't even care. I'm about to make such a fool out of him. And that makes me so happy. But then, of course, he's like, and this is so cute, he's like, I have to first go to the hotel and attend to my mustaches. They are deplorably limp from the heat of traveling. And he's also like, and then I need to dust my coat and rearrange my tie. Once he does those things, then he can go and just like totally break Giraud's heart. Sadly, this joy is short-lived because Hastings is like, forget it, Poirot. You don't even know. There has been another murder. And Poirot is like, all jauntiness is gone. He's so surprised. And he says with like such sadness, I am all wrong. I have failed. Giraud will mock himself at me.
Wow.
He feels like his theory has been totally like demolished. But then I love this. That is also short-lived because he's like, well, here's the thing. It's impossible for me to be wrong, so I must still be right. And I think that the only way that this new murder is possible is that, and then he doesn't really say any more. But then he does a brilliant, this is almost like a little Sherlock Holmesy of him. He's like, Hastings, is the dead man middle-aged? Was he found in the shed? Had he been dead for 48 hours? And had he been stabbed in the same manner as Monsieur Renault? And Hastings is like, how do you know this? Poirot, like, don't prank me. Like, this is impossible that you'd know. And Poirot's like, no, no, no. I'm right. I used my little gray cells. So they take a shortcut from the train station across the golf links. Again, I feel like every reference to, like, we had to cross the golf links is just to remind us that they're there. So the title is justified. And Poirot is like, maybe there were two knives because this knife was a special commemorative World War I knife made just for Jack. And I guess the logic is that, like, because there was so much effort put into, like, the unique design of this one knife, maybe you would make more to, like, justify all the effort and labor. I wouldn't have gotten there. I did not know that about commemorative knife culture. No. So anyways, we get that. They go to the shed. And unlike Giraud, who is like, has been on his little knee pads, Poirot just looks at it with a, quote, cursory glance. And he immediately goes to the bundle of clothes that Giraud misses. And Poirot asks, is this the gardener's clothes? Then he looks at the dead man's boots and fingernails and then his nice clothes. And Poirot notices and points this out that, like, there's kind of foam on the dead man's lips. And I wish that we could give the dead man a name, but, like, literally he just never gets one.
Right.
Poirot then looks at the knife wound and we get his little shining green eyes and he notices kind of out loud, because I think members of the crime club were there. He's like, there's no blood on the knife. There's barely any blood on the body. And he's like, this man was definitely stabbed after he died. But then he kind of says out loud, like, right, Giraud? Like, you've already figured this out, haven't you? Giraud's like, no. He's like, the knife was put in there to make it look like he'd been stabbed. He definitely died of an epileptic fit. And everyone is like, what? No. But then Dr. Duran looks at it and he's like, oh yeah, you're right. So, like,
which is excellent medical. Like, that's just amazing. Oh yeah, sure. Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yep.
Literally Hastings is like, Poirot was the hero of the hour. Poirot's like, great, now we all really should go to lunch, because Poirot always wants lunch. That's what we also learned in this book. Giraud is like a last attempt. He's like, but look at the woman's hair. And Poirot's like, ugh, this is so pointless. He's trying to mislead us. Let's go get lunch. So they go get lunch. And then Hastings is like, Poirot, I can't take it any longer. Tell me what happened in Paris. Poirot takes a newspaper cutting out of his pocket, and there is a woman's photograph. So, like, she's above an article or something. Mm-hmm. And it is none other than Madame Dupray. But they call her Madame Beraldi. And Hastings is like, oh my goodness. I remember this case. She was involved in a murder trial that sparked international interest. The Beraldi case. Oh. Oh, we finally made it.
And I will just say that the first time I read this book and I got to that part, I was like, what? There's a whole other case? Like, I just need to go sit on the beach. But the second time through, I was very excited. I do want to preface this, if it's okay, by saying that I found it, and I'm considerably older than you are, but I still found this to be difficult. Not that anything is wrong with having it be framed this way, that these people that were involved in this infamous murder case from however many years ago are part of the current situation and that no one is recognizing them. That makes sense. But in my brain, it was very hard to get there because of the internet.
I get what you're saying. So you're saying it's like hard to wrap your head around the fact that that information wouldn't be readily available, because like things from the past can become so present with the internet. Like you can just look at a photo and then you're like, cool. Whereas like things truly can pre-internet lose themselves to like time.
Yes.
Is kind of what you're saying. Yeah.
No one's going to remember those faces because they don't have it on their computer and their TV. And if they have a newspaper, there might be one photo.
You could recede into obscurity.
Yes.
Basically. And that's possible, and then you could reemerge as someone else. So Chad and everyone else, let me tell you a story. Think back. We're going 20 years ago. We're in Paris, and a man named Monsieur Arnaud Beroldi from Lyon arrives in Paris, or I guess Paris, if I'm going to be consistent with my sounds, with his wife and young daughter. And Monsieur Beroldi worked in the wine trade. He's like, they describe him as like unremarkable, but like pleasant and modest and just has like a nice life. He's middle-aged. He's just like, I am very comfortable, super happy with my wife and my young daughter. But his wife was, quote, gilded with a brush of romance. She had charm. She was beautiful. You know, if he's just like your average French Joe, then she's this kind of mysterious, larger-than-life character. She's charming. She has these rumors swirling around her, this mystery, because as we know, she is the mysterious Madame de Bray. The rumors say that maybe she also has mysterious antecedents. So she was maybe a daughter of like a Russian or Austrian royal, and everybody kind of saw her at the center of this mysterious secret, and she never denied it. And even she hinted that like some of the rumors were true, some of them weren't. And she started kind of hinting that like danger surrounded her because of the secret that has to do with her identity. And so kind of in their social circle was this like young, handsome, dashing lawyer named Georges Queneau. And Madame Beroldi, like they say, encouraged him, which I don't know. I think that that verb in these kind of stories is so interesting. But like they started having a thing, but it was pretty discreet.
Okay. So encouraged is more than flirting.
Yeah. And okay. I think they also put it all on women when they're like, she encouraged his advances. It kind of is one of those things where it takes all agency off the men who are just like throwing themselves at women like Hastings. And it's like, it's one thing if you get that behavior towards you, but it's another thing if you encourage it, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. So they're like, of course, Georges Queneau would be so interested in her, but she encouraged him. And so then the relationship started. Anyways. There's another man, because of course we just can't ever have two people in one story here. We have to have like many extras. And so here enters Hiram Petrap, which is my favorite name, I think, in this whole book. He is a wealthy American, and he also is in love with Madame Beroldi, but he's very proper about it. Madame Beroldi and Georges Queneau apparently are like, yeah, they're... like, everybody is saying they're doing things the wrong way a little bit.
What? Okay, but wait. So, yeah. So Hiram P. Trapp, which sounds to me like a fake name that Poirot would use to sign in somewhere, to sign into a hotel.
I think that's what I'm going to tell Starbucks my name is from Hiram now on. Hiram P.
Trapp with two P's. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. This is why I get confused. There are a lot of reasons. I drank a lot in my 20s. Okay, so Madame Beroldi is married to an unremarkable but pleasant middle-aged dude. And then she starts to have an affair with this person who's among their friends named Georges Queneau. But then Hiram P. Trapp, a wealthy American, comes in and he's falling in love. But he was proper about starting an affair with her too? Okay.
Good question. I don't think they started an affair. I feel like he probably made his feelings known. Who knows what this is like for Monsieur Beroldi? Like,
this poor guy's trying to sell some wine and like,
yeah, I know. And also, like, it's not bad being married to a wine merchant. Imagine your life.
In Paris. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I feel like you're actually living the good life. But anyways, but it's not enough for Madame Beroldi. Yeah. So I feel like maybe he was like, that Madame Beroldi is pretty nice, but I'm not going to like actually make advances. I might just like flirt with her and be like, hey, if you weren't married, I'd like to be with you. That's my version of being proper. and making your love clear to a married woman.
It's amazing. Yes.
That's how I would do it.
Okay. That's so, so this is what I'm saying. You just pardon me and we can cut this out. But so they're at a party. They're all at a big party in Paris, but Madame Baraldi's husband is finishing up some wine sales like a few blocks away and he's going to show up a little bit late. And so Hiram P. Trapp is kind of like hanging out and just kind of being very American and wealthy among all of these Parisians. And then they notice some, he notices out of the corner of his eye some rustling behind a giant curtain. And then all of a sudden, 5 seconds later, Madame Baraldi and Georges Canot kind of come out straightening their clothes. Yeah. And then Hiram P. Trapp is just like, I'm quite fond of you, ma'am. Like, I think.
Yes, like, that's exactly what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
That seems like an odd vibe.
It is. You know what? And they don't say in this, like, in Hastings' retelling, they don't really talk about how uncomfortable everyone is. This could be very awkward for everyone involved.
I hear a lot of, like, throat clearing among three of them when the husband shows up. Like he's like,
God. Yeah, everybody's like, don't say
what
anything.
What a rough day I had selling wine. Really? That's interesting. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. So I loved your narration of that. So interestingly, once we've established all of this, Madame Baraldi starts acting worried about her husband. She's like, there is some kind of political secret. And that should kind of ring a little alarm bell for us about like a mysterious secret that nobody can actually articulate what it is. Then the mirroring only gets more specific and just like more complex. One day, a cleaning woman finds their apartment door open and she hears, I'd say distressed moans from the bedroom, because I had written moans from the bedroom. And I'm like, no, that's a different thing.
That's a different thing.
Distressed sounds from the bedroom. And she finds Madame Baraldi bound on the floor and Monsieur Baraldi on the bed in a pool of blood, and he had been murdered by a knife. So this is the exact scene that Poirot was thinking of but couldn't kind of put his finger on when he encounters Madame Renaud bound and, like, then her husband stabbed. Madame Baraldi says, and this is her retelling when she's, like, rescued, that two masked men, not bearded men, had, like, tied her up and demanded that Monsieur Baraldi give them information again about, like, a mysterious secret. And he was like, no, I will not tell you. And then one of them stabbed him in the heart, stole his keys, and took all of his papers from a nearby safe. Oh, and she did say, she was like, they had beards, they had masks. But Madame Baraldi said they sure sounded Russian, which I think is like, we just replaced that with South American.
Here. Yeah, exactly.
And so the story is like so famous so quickly, like the newspapers just eat it up. Of course, the bearded men were never found because they didn't exist. And then Madame Baraldi was arrested and charged with her husband's murder.
Now, I have a quick question. Yeah, I just want to make sure about this, because was there something about Madame Baraldi not being tied particularly tightly?
Yeah. Okay, good point.
Yeah, and so that's why when Poirot, even though he might not be aware of it at that point in time, is hearing the echoes of the case when he asks Madame Renaud to Mrs. Renaud to show him where she had been bound. And then he is like, there are definitely marks on your wrist. Yeah. So you were bound tightly.
That's almost like a lesson from the past, because hers were loose. And so that was a big reason why people were like, you're making this up. Like, there's no evidence that anybody came in. And so eventually she does get arrested and she's charged with her husband's murder. And so the trial becomes a huge, like, again, like, it was already a media sensation. Now it's huge. Now it becomes international. We can imagine Hastings reading about it. It's one of those things where the murderer is beautiful and mysterious. And so it's like, of course, the like press is going to eat it up. Soon it's discovered that she's actually the one responsible for creating the cloud of mystery around her. All of those rumors, they're all made up. She came from like a really normal French background and her parents were fruit merchants. So she wasn't royal. And she actually, like even before then had, and I'm not sure how this worked, and I think we just kind of brush over it, but she had been like kind of financially benefiting from her rumors. Like maybe she was enjoying a more luxurious lifestyle because people had kind of assumed that there was more going on behind the scenes with her like past. Mm-hmm. So maybe she was getting treated as though she were royalty. So we've got a little bit of like a grifter thing going on here. This is where, like, I had to read it a couple times and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. The motivation for the murder was actually Hiram P. Trapp, the rich American.
The rich American with his proper way, yes, of flirting with a married woman.
I will take your wife the proper way.
Exactly.
The proper American way. So she uses Georges Queneau because while he's dashing and young, he's like not an American bajillionaire. And so she's like, Georges, I love you. Let's kill my husband and run away. And so she makes up this whole story about how Monsieur Baroldi was mistreating her. And so Georges Queneau is like so mad. He like feels like this passionate sense of protection. So he's like, of course I'll kill your husband. So they come up with the like fake beard story, da, 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 tying up. They create all of that. But Madame Baroldi's whole plan was to blame it all on Georges Queneau and marry Hiram P. Trapp and enjoy being a wealthy wife to an American who is also proper and rich. That's her little knot that she's tangled up. So the whole trial, Madame Baroldi is like, I did have Russian heritage and I was switched at birth. So she kind of just denies everything. She really like doubles down. But Georges Queneau, he's not a dum-dum. He disappears before he can be found, which again, as you had said kind of earlier, that's easier to do. It's easier to disappear. But he feels so guilty that he was duped. He's so frustrated by it. He sends a letter to the French police explaining what happened. Like, I was tricked. I'm so mad about this. Like, don't let her get away with it. This is such a classic liar thing that like actually people do, is like, so now when she's caught, she's like, well, okay, I admit that I was lying. She's like, we invented the Russians and I had blamed everything on Queneau, but he threatened me to keep silent about the murder. So she like flips it. She like concedes a little bit to match the truth of Queneau's story to a point. But then she's like, he was really the mastermind behind all of it. And I'm getting thrown under the bus here because he's disappeared and he hasn't come forward. And so she is really charming. She's beautiful and she's really good at fooling people. On the witness stand, she made herself feel really credible. And she does this concession thing where she says, I'm guilty of much, but not the crime. We end with that Queneau was never found, but Madame Baroldi was acquitted and she disappeared with her daughter.
Who is Marta.
Marta, yeah.
Yes, murderous. The actual murderous. Mm-hmm. So, okay, here's my question. I want to just preface this by saying I'm not asking you this as if you're Agatha Christie or as if even you were, say, like the foremost expert on an author like J.D. Bricker. I'm not asking you this question way. Mm. I'm almost asking like this to just vent for a second because, okay.
Yeah, okay. So I'm clear about the situation.
What happened with Mr. Trapp at the end of the trial? Why didn't she get together with him? What was the reason?
She was arrested first, I think.
But then she was acquitted.
Here is my guess that is just made up, is he probably was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this.
Okay, so he got tired of the drama.
He's like, I am proper, and this is not proper. Goodbye.
Okay, that's good. I also, now that I'm looking at this, when this chapter ends in my book, we're at page 150, and the book itself is only 248 pages long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that means that almost two-thirds of the way through the book, or close to it, an entire new case is just dropped into our laps.
Yep.
And it's like, here's all this other stuff that you now have to figure out. I also wanted to quickly mention, this was something that while you were doing that amazing summary, that I thought, which was Madame Baraldi is in this very similar situation, minus the husband, to Jack, where there are two interested people in them at the same time. And so I feel it. I don't know. It's almost like hearing you say the thing about Madame Baraldi being pursued, being married, but then also pursued by Hiram and then also George, is a different power dynamic and all this stuff. But I feel like the Jack thing almost softens you up for that. Like, although we don't know at that point in time. Oh, no, that's great. Okay. Yeah. God, this is so...
On a reread. Okay. My idea that I'm going to put forward is that this book is so different on a reread that it's almost like a completely different book. Because reading it, knowing everything, you can have that experience. You're like, okay, I know about Jack. And then I'm like primed for it. And then I'm able to see... Like, those two characters are talking to each other in a way that I hadn't really realized until you'd said it. But on a first read, all of this is so confusing.
It's almost like Madame Baraldi / Dubray's daughter, Martha, learned how to deal with the love triangle from the fact that her father was stabbed in the heart. It's like, right?
Okay.
Isn't that what...
Yeah.
What happened? That's how she solved it.
Yeah. Was
by not in the heart, in the back, but by murdering the person who was in the way.
And I hadn't thought about that too, that these parallels, these mirrors, these repetitions and doubles are unending.
It's but unending. Yeah,
like she, it's almost like she's inherited that as a possibility, I guess, for solving a problem.
Yeah, because she obviously knew what was going on when she was a kid. Her mom had to be acquitted after a sensational case that made the headlines all over the world. So I'm sure that had an effect on her. Okay, should we move on to chapter 17?
I think we should. Okay, so chapter 17. So I guess Hastings and Poirot are both kind of in the exploded brain emoji stage where they're like, oh my God, huge info drop. Now we have all these new details. So take us through this chapter that everyone is included in.
It's easy to forget this because we have just gone through an entire case that happened 20 years ago. But I think Poirot is still a little high on his massive victory at the end of chapter 15.
When he gets to reveal the newspaper clipping from his pocket, right? They're at lunch. Yeah. His lunch reveal.
Right. He's feeling very much like, I knew there was something. And now he is, in his mind, figuring things out at a rate that other people aren't, or he's seeing more of the picture because of who he is. And I feel like he's trying desperately to get Hastings to get on the same page, or at least in the same book as he's in. And it's just kind of not happening.
No.
I think he's extending a little bit of grace to Hastings by saying, hey, I also had this wrong too. Like, I did not, just so you know, don't feel badly about it. I can't remember where they are while they're talking. Are they in?
So, yes, we are still at the resort. I'm picturing them on their little like bistro chairs, or maybe now they're in like kind of a loungy situation. They're like maybe having some like post-meal beverage of some kind, and they're just waiting for Jack to arrive.
Can I ask you a quick question, Caitlin?
If
they're down there and they're sitting on these cool bistro chairs with all these delicious snacks, why are we hanging out by the shed?
I feel like it's time for us to move.
Should we maybe go down to town?
Okay, let's discuss this chapter as we walk down back to the resort.
Okay.
And you know what? I'll use my guest pass and you can, we can let you in for a limited amount of time with the agreement that you change your clothes first because you would offend the guests otherwise.
Okay. That's a great idea. I do have to go down to the beach to get the satchel that I keep my clothes in. So maybe we'll do that after this chapter.
Yeah, but we'll just walk. So we'll at least get down there.
So let's make our way down to town and talk about the rest of this chapter 17. There is a bunch of discussion between Hastings and Poirot about what Perot has found. And then we find out that Perot has, in fact, summoned Jack down to, because he doesn't want to talk to Jack with Giraud around. And so then Jack shows up and they have a lovely little discussion in which it becomes very obvious that Perot is enlisting Jack on his side, which is kind of interesting. Like he's like, I have things for you to do. And later on, we kind of find out that the reason he's asking him to do these things is because it almost feels like Perot knows Giraud is going to go after Jack. And Perot has to make sure to, for himself that Jack is not guilty.
They need Jack out of the way, so they give him a little job, which Poirot was always very good at. He's like, I am going to delegate for my own purposes, which is to, like, go behind this person's back.
Yeah. Well, let me get this shrubbery out of your way. Give me a second. Yeah. Okay. There you go. God, they're so thorny. Thank you. Ow.
I know. Okay. Yeah. Right. We should.
Wow.
It's just constant shrubbery. Okay.
Okay.
So
yes.
Let's go play by play what's going on at this lovely luncheon. So Hastings is like, this is why I recognize this case. It is so famous. And he's like, oh my gosh, I have figured out everything. So Hastings goes from like, we knew nothing to I know everything. And of course, as you had mentioned, we're like not even 2/3 of the way through the book yet. Good God. And so we get this quote where Hastings is temporarily excited. He says, just for the moment, in my excitement, it seemed to clear the whole matter up. I admit that I am impulsive, and Poirot deplores my custom of jumping to conclusions. But I think I have some excuse in this instance. The remarkable way in which this discovery justified Poirot's point of view struck me at once. So he's like, I know I jump to conclusions all the time, but like this time I am totally justified. And so he's like, Poirot, I see it all so clearly. And Poirot's such a jerk. He's like, and since you see everything now, mon ami, what exactly is it that you see? He's like, no, you don't. Tell me what's on your mind, Hastings. So Hastings is like, well, it's so clear that Mademoiselle Dubray, who was Mademoiselle Borelli, and we're going to still call her Dubray, I think, right?
Yeah.
We're going to stick with Dubray and Renault just because that's what, we can't change now.
No.
He's like, well, she killed Monsieur Renault. And Poirot was like, well, hold on, let's like work back. Why do you actually think that she was guilty of the first crime 20 years ago? And Hastings is like, well, I think she was guilty. And Poirot's like, yeah, I think she was guilty too. But right now, we have to assume she's innocent and we have to go back and like prove everything. And Hastings is like, oh my God.
Yeah.
We have to go back 20 years and assume her innocence and prove her guilty of two crimes. Poirot's like, okay, well, Hastings, what's the motive there for Mademoiselle Dubray to kill Monsieur Renault? And Hastings is like, I just can't think of anything. And Poirot's like, yeah, there's no motive. She's benefiting from blackmailing Monsieur Renault. She doesn't want him dead. She's making all this money.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Hastings is like, well, Poirot, let me remind you that money is not the only motive for murder. And Poirot's like, even though you were just being a jerk there, you're right. Like, there are all these other different motives. A crime passionnel, or like a passionate, like a crime of passion. There's like homicidal mania or religious fanaticism. And he calls that like murder for an idea. You're murdering to like prove a point or because of some like moral or idea that you're defending. But this is where we get some unchecked misogyny. Because Poirot's like, but a woman can't dig a grave. And Hastings is like, you're right.
A woman doesn't even know how to use a shovel. I mean, I think what side do I dig with? I mean,
yeah, what's you good? Say shovel and we can't even describe it.
I don't
one.
Even know.
It's so like, weird.
Wait, huh? Yeah. Man.
Yeah. It's like, how did that hole get there?
Right. There must be a lot of men around.
Okay. I just have to say, side note, that when I was a child, I had, are we surprised that I had a pretty involved imagination? No.
Shocking.
Yeah, I know, right? We had in our backyard, for some reason, you know, like you're digging around in the dirt as you are as a kid. And like some of the stones that would appear were these like perfectly round white stones. And I was like, well, All of this is evidence that buried underneath my house is a castle. And these white stones are like the material that the castle is made out of. So let me tell you, I tried to find it. That involved digging many holes. And I am sad to report that I never found the castle that was buried under my house. One day I'll get there. Maybe when I learn what a shovel is.
You were just using jewelry, right? To dig?
Jewelry, like fashion magazines, mm-hmm. just fluffy boas.
Fluffy boas. Yeah. I remember one time you were like, I have to get a new blouse to dig with. And, yeah. Yes. So mm-hmm. Perot is being completely sexist here. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So women can't dig graves. So like there has to be a man involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which holds up in the story, mm-hmm. actually. So
actually, yeah. So Hastings is like, okay, so what do you think, Poirot, about this? And this is where they're like kind of riffing off of each other, kind of brainstorming, but it's like more of a one-sided brainstorm because Poirot knows more. So Hastings is like, okay, Poirot, what do you make of the similarity between these crimes? And Poirot's like, yeah, there is this really interesting similarity, but Madame Renaud is the one who is lying about it and telling us this story. It's not Madame Dubray. And they're probably not working together. So, like, what's up with that? And Poirot, like, as they're brainstorming, he's like, we draw very near the truth, which, as always, is very curious and very interesting. And Poirot admits, my friend, in many ways, I have been an imbecile, but at least I see clearly. So he's like, this has been really complicated, but like the entire time, I've been the one seeing everything.
Yes.
There have been times that I've made mistakes, but in no way am I so blind with my nose to the ground like Giraud. And so then we get a little bit of a riddle from Poirot. He says, I know absolutely why Monsieur Renaud called for me to come to Merlinville. And he says, He says, there are here not one crime, but two. The first I have solved. The second, eh bien, I will confess, I am not sure. So we know he's like halfway there. And Hastings is like, wait, Poirot. So there are two crimes, but didn't the second man die of natural causes? And he's like, mysteriously, that crime doesn't need a murder, but two crimes need two bodies. And this part, even though when I knew it was happening, I was like, I'm done. This is a math problem I don't want to solve.
But the thing that's so difficult to understand is the kind of lovely, I think, literary irony of that Renaud dug his own grave. And it wasn't intentional, right? Mm-hmm. It was unintentional that he did it. And so, like, that's really hard to wrap your mind around at this point in time in the book. Yeah.
And so Hastings is like, oh God, okay, let me try to figure this out. And he says, it had just occurred to me that though there were seven women directly and indirectly connected with the case. And then when he said it out loud, I was like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And he names them Mrs. Renaud, Madame Dubray, and her daughter, the mysterious visitor, and the three servants. There really only needs to be one. the three servants was, with the exception of old Auguste, who could hardly count. Poor Auguste. He's the gardener.
He's the gardener.
There was, and so he's kind of narrowing down on Jack. He's like, there was only one man, Jack Renaud, and a man must have dug the grave. And he thinks this in italics. So we know it's important. So like Hastings, kind of like Giraud, is zeroing in on Jack. Just as Hastings is having this thought, Jack could be the only grave digger, which is not true. He comes into the hotel and Poirot's like, can we please talk here? Because I don't want to be around Giraud. Mm-hmm. And Jack is like, yeah, Giraud sucks. And so they have a little like moment of talking trash about Giraud. And so they're connecting. I feel like Poirot's being really disarming here. And then, you know, once they've gotten on good terms, Poirot asks Jack, why didn't you tell Ote that you were in Merlinville the night of the crime? And Jack is like, obviously I wasn't there. And Poirot, he kind of corners him. The quote is, Poirot looked at him, his eyes narrowed, cat-like, until they showed a gleam of green. And so then he comes back with this, he kind of, again, he's like Jack is the mouse and Poirot is the cat. And Poirot is going to make his next advance. And he's like, so innocently, he's like, I must have been mistaken about that because all the porters saw you at the train station and they told me. And so then Jack does a move that I think you and I had called the O.J. Simpson move, where he's like, well, if I were there, you know, this is what would have happened. And Poirot's like, okay, explain. And he's like, I would have been visiting Martha to solidify like our commitment to each other before I go on my really long, dumb trip. And so that's kind of his reason for if he were to be in Merlinville that night, that's why he would be there. But then he kind of just goes into narrating exactly what happened. He's like, well, but then I missed the train. And so I had to walk to another station and hire a car to Cherbourg. Poirot's like, Jack, thanks for telling me, but that's a long walk to the next station. And Jack is like, well, I felt like walking.
Yeah, it's an interesting exchange because it's also the way that Poirot is interacting with Jack is that he likes Jack. And he knows that Jack is lying, but he also doesn't care that much. So in this, the tone is very much of like the feeling it would be stunning if it turned out that Jack was the murderer, the way that Poirot is talking to him, because he doesn't really play with the murderer. Like, whereas like you're saying, he's a cat playing with a toy here. And so I don't think that. Yeah, I think that he's very much like, okay, I know I can rule Jack out at this point.
Exactly. And this gives me very much like Mary vibes from Styles when Poirot's like, you can trust me to tell me the truth. Huge wink, trust Papa Poirot. I feel like it's such a reflection of that. And so then Poirot was like, oh, okay, Jack has left. Let's follow him. And I'm really glad he's going to the train station because I totally made that up and I wanted him out of the way.
Right. Right. Oh, and also speaking of when Jack says, I felt like walking, we have now kind of transferred from the grassy trail to a more gravel trail on our way to town, just so you know. So if you hear anything different, Caitlin, that's what's happening. Yeah.
That's why. Okay. I'm really glad. I'm glad you narrated to me where I am.
Well, I am a straight white man, so.
I mean, okay, that tracks. What would we do without you?
Thrive, flourish.
I know, yeah, yeah. Not have to stop and roll our eyes a ton, sigh heavily. Okay, so Poirot is a really cute thing about this, though. He's like, Jack is going to go inquire about a mythical valise left by the mythical foreigners. Yes, mon ami, all of that was a little invention of my own. So he's very proud of his deception.
Yes.
And so they go to Villa Genevieve, which I think then sets us up so nicely for the next chapter, which is a lot of hijinks.
Yes, there are a lot of hijinks that have to do with Poirot's, the way that he wants things to be done, having to be truncated a little bit, which is very, very funny.
Yeah, he gets upset.
Yes.
Okay, but I think first, you know, Chad, you and I have been walking for a while. I think it's time that we like...
My calves are cramping a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, so let's take a little rest on a bench, maybe like look out at the ocean.
Yeah.
Who knows what conversations we'll overhear in the nearby foliage, which is actually where we pick back up in chapter 18 is some more hiding in shrubs. So I think we're going to like prepare ourselves for that. Yeah, what else are you going to do between now and the next time we chat?
Where are we going to meet before the next recording?
I'd say right back here. So it's going to be a day or two. So you could just like sit on this bench for 48 hours.
I'm going to sit here for a little while. I know that you had an invitation to a socialite event this evening.
I have plans. Yeah. I have so many plans.
You have a bunch of plans tonight. I had an astonishing, kind of, I won't say it was a conversation, but it was kind of like a mental bonding with a crab last night at the beach. And so I think I'm going to try to get back into that mindset, just kind of figure out what's going on in that guy's life, you know? Like, it's so crazy to be just him on the beach. And yeah, so I think I'm just going to head back to my little book hovel on the beach and awesome. And just hang out. Yeah.
And our previous agreement goes that if we see each other on the street between now and then, we pretend like we don't know each other.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry I messed that up last time because I raised one of my eyebrows and you gave me a withering glare.
Well deserved.
Sorry. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. Perfect. So we'll go do that.
Yes. No, that sounds amazing. Yes. Fantastic. I look forward to meeting back here at this weirdly uncomfortable bench.
So uncomfortable.
Okay. All right. See you then.
Okay.
Okay. Uh-huh. Bye. Okay.